Thou
The living room's dark, save for light being cast from the big TV screen and the imminent sunrise that's teasing the one starry sky with whispers of morning.
Hi, George.
Hi, Lions. How goes it?
No, wait. I don't like that one. I want to start over. Hey, George.
Hey, Lions. How goes it?
Nah, it didn't feel good either. Hang on. Wait. If we keep just restarting, we'll eventually get the right equipment.
Okay.
Hey, George.
Hi, Beckham.
Oh, so close. I got the sword I wanted, but that was not the secondary weapon I wanted.
Right. Yeah. So you gotta just keep spamming it.
Hey, George.
Hi, King, God amongst men.
There we go.
There it is.
That's when you get S level double plus stuff right at the beginning.
Yeah, we're like, woo.
So, hey, what do we play? We played.
No one is going to believe that was improvised, by the way. Like, everybody's going to believe that was scripted.
Oh, yeah. No. This is the part of being an artist, right, in any field, is whatever you are trying to say, like, this thing is genuine. There's always a contingent of people who are like, nah. And it's, you know, that's fine. You don't have to believe.
It's okay.
We know the truth.
Yep. But what do we play?
We played The Dead Cells, also just called Dead Cells.
Also known as Cell post Gohan Super Saiyan 2. We played Cell post Gohan Super Saiyan 2.
You had to dig deep for that joke, but I appreciated that anyway. So I have to dwell on this one thing for just a second. Do you play a lot of games on your phone?
I mean, no, I play a game on my phone.
Tetris?
No.
Bejeweled?
Look, you don't know of it. I've been playing it since before it was cool. But no, make your point now, and I'll let you know if delving into the depth of what specific game I play bears on the conversation.
Well, okay, so we played Dead Cells, which came out actually literally almost exactly a year ago. Came out August 7th, 2018. I knew it was recent. I didn't realize it was that recent, but that's kind of cool, right? But the thing that blew me away is as I was grabbing the Wikipedia article to throw into the show notes, one of the few things that actually goes into the show notes, other than the Patreon link where you can go and support us and where you can find me on Twitter to harass us.
Money, 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 money.
Money.
Nice.
Yeah.
I was going through the Wikipedia, you know, to find the release date, and it lists the systems that the game is on. And it's on, you know, Steam and PS4 and Xbox. And then I was like, wait a minute. In 2019, they're releasing it on Android and iOS? What psychopath would play a game that requires controls like this on a smartphone? Like, even if they're guaranteeing that people are going to play it with a controller, because you can pair a controller to a smartphone or like an iPad, even if they are requiring you to do that to play the game, why would you choose that platform to play it on? The game is not that over-the-top processor intensive. You can play this on pretty much any run-of-the-mill laptop. So if you have to take it portable, and I think it might even be on the Switch, so you could play it on the Switch if you had to take it portable. But oh my God, this would be so awful on a smartphone. Like, I almost want to buy it just out of like sheer morbid curiosity. But that is why I asked you, because I was like, what kind of soon to be mass murderer plays a game that requires controls like this on a touchscreen?
Well, and also too, that requires, I don't know, like, and I guess, you know, different strokes for different folks, but this degree of focus and concentration, you know,
right?
Like, I mean, you know, yeah, like you can play Flappy Bird, but you know, I mean, when you like the cycle time is really short and, you know, it's not that intensive. You're not saying they're trying to crunch numbers and swap out equipment. And I mean, this is a relatively intense gaming experience. I mean, like, I've played it some with my son, which we'll get into. And yeah, like there are literally times where he'll be playing and he will just hand me the controller and say like, no, this is all you now. Right? This is gone beyond my skill sets. And I'm like, it really probably did a level ago, but good on you.
So what is your one phone game? Oh, wait. Is it chess?
No.
Okay, that was a safe guess, though.
It was. No, that was a safe guess. No, I like living with the illusion in my mind that I'm good at chess, and playing chess against a computer is antithetical to that notion.
Yeah, that's how I feel about speaking Khalsa. I'm sure I'd be awesome at it, but, I mean, there's no reason to just rub in everyone's face how eloquently I could speak that language if I wanted to, so I'm just never, ever going to.
Yes. Yes, those two things are the same.
Yeah.
Anyway, no, it's a Dice Hunter is the name of the cell phone game that I play.
It's, I don't know that one.
It is. Now, it's free. It like most free-to-play games, kind of has a paywall, but the nice thing is that the game is mindless and enjoyable enough that if you like, I've been playing it for like 2 years now and have not spent... I spent very, very, very little money on, like, maybe like $5, you know?
Just $6,000 tops. No more than that.
Yeah, I mean, oh, yeah, definitely no more than, what do they say, 3 months' salary, right?
Yes. Somewhere a mobile phone game designer was just like, ooh.
Yeah, he just got his wings.
Yes, wings.
Yes. Yeah. But anyways, So normally at this point we would say, what was your nostalgia experience? But the real question for this one that we need to ask is what alerted you to this game?
So this game, like I said, I knew it was recent. I didn't realize it was this recent. So I had heard people make mention of it. I had gotten some reference to it in like the general background noise of the gaming community, but I didn't know what it was. Like, I didn't realize it was a roguelite Metroidvania. I think they call it a Roguevania. So I was just like, ooh, beautiful pixel art. I'm sure it's an interesting game. And then I went back to my giant, never-ending backlog of games to play. And then you were like, you know, oh, I've been playing Dead Cells. I was like, oh. And you were like, yeah, it's kind of like a Metroidvania. And I was like, but you hate those. And so that, like, that alone, right, was one of those things. It's, you know, if someone says like, oh, you hate this thing, I also hate this thing, except for this one, right? Because then you feel like you have some shared understanding. But but then it's like, no, I love this thing and you hate this thing. So is this a terrible example of the thing I love, or is this such an incredible paragon example that even you can't deny that it's bad? And that was what made me have to play it, because I was like, well, now I need to know which one of those extremes it is, because it's got to be one or the other.
Yes, and what I think, and so for me, my new nostalgia experience for this was, you know, again, I'm just perpetually on the hunt for games that are within the spectrum of games literacy that my son can play them, but I can also enjoy them, you know, because it's easy to find a game that, you know, that Teddy can play and that make me want to claw my eyes out. And it's easy to find a game that I can play that Teddy can't even grasp or touch, you know? And it's really interesting, tangent time. It's really interesting. Like, some of the constraints that you don't even realize are in there until you start looking for it, because I'll find one where it checks all of the boxes except text-based. And it's like, well, Teddy can't read yet, so that's a no-go, you know? And so, and even though this game has just bodies and bodies of text, right? You don't need any of it to just play and enjoy the game. And the nice, especially on normal mode after you've, you know, gotten a bunch of the upgrades, right, and basically made the game easier. That being said, some of the non-tactical or strategic choices that Teddy will make, not being able to read and differentiate between different items, breaks my heart sometimes, because he will dump like a level 4 double plus brutality weapon when he's been dumping everything into red, because that's all he knows. He's just like, red! And, you know, for a shield that I'm like, oh no, why would you do that, buddy? You've got like one in survival and you don't even know how to use the shield that well. I mean, one time he literally chose a loadout of ice shards and Ice Blast. And I was like, you got no damage dealer, son. Like, you got to learn these things early. Like, you have nothing that's going to close the deal. All you're going to do is just sit there and freeze these people, and you're never going to close it out. And so then Teddy switches to pacifist mode, where he just rolls all over the level until he finds the exit, which is a surefire way to throw good money after bad, because the levels are getting more and more hard and more complicated, and he's still got his starting equipment, which, again, is Ice Charge and Ice Blast. So I'll just like be watching this happening and just like being like, it's fine, it's fine. So like normally we do a 3-to-1 split where he takes three turns and I take one turn, because that time wise kind of works out. All of that being said, I was playing that with him and I was like, this is actually, it does a number of things that I just hadn't seen in another game before. And I was like, hey, we should play this.
And also this will confuse the hell out of Lions, because it's a Metroidvania.
Yeah,
which I think we really need to try and work the term backtracker into the lexicon, but I don't know if either of us are popular enough to make that kind of thing catch on. So what we need to do is find super famous people and incept it into their minds, because you have that technology just laying around, right? Like the little box, little suitcase thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The box. Yeah. I've got that. It's right next to the box with the small bomb in it, though, and there's no real clear descriptors on it. It'll be fine, though.
It'll be fine,
I'm sure.
Yeah,
it'll work. There shouldn't be anything wrong with me bringing a nondescript box into a hotel room saying that I'm looking for a famous person.
Yeah, I see no problem with this. So let's talk about the visuals. I have mixed feelings about the visuals in this game, because everything feels lovingly crafted. It's all beautiful, high-res pixel art. Like, just, I think even all of the particle effects and stuff might even all be pixel art, or if not, they tried really hard to make it look like pixel art. So it's just, everything looks super retro, and I love, if this is your first episode of Nostalgia Goggles, I really like this style of artwork. I gush about it a lot. The one place it falls down for me is, every once in a while, it will do like an artistic camera zoom. Like when you first get to a boss, it like zooms way in on the boss, right? And then it like pans back out, depending on the screen that I'm playing on. Because I was originally playing this on my laptop, and my laptop screen is 13 inches. My television is 43 inches, right? So when you see...
That's at least twice as big.
It is. it's a nice size. But when you see some of these things stretched way out, and you're not sitting that far away because of the weird way my desk is set up, some of them are just rough enough around the edges that I was like, "Yeah, like why is that as like cornery as it is?" And this is, I want to be clear, this is a stylistic choice. This says nothing about the quality of the artwork. This is just my personal like feeling that sometimes there are corners where I don't think there should be corners. But you can tell because of how highly polished all of the animations are, all of the backgrounds are, how varied all of the like little kind of atmospheric things, like broken doorways and the water and like the plants that are like creeping up and like falling over candles and stuff. Like, there's no way you would do all of that and then make things blocky because you don't know how to make them smooth. They just chose in some places to make them blocky. And I just was like, eh. But You cannot deny the quality of this artwork. Everything, especially the backgrounds, are just stunningly rendered. Really, really gorgeous.
Yeah, I would agree that this is... this particular style, there are definitely some areas where... yeah, it does feel a little off. Especially with, like, the bosses. Particularly, like, the Hand of the King, who's the last boss, you know, who he himself is very large. You know, we're just, it feels like, and I'm sure somebody smarter than me could put a word to it, but where I think it shatters the fourth wall to a degree, because they are, the way that they're making it look retro is not by actually using pixels. They're using hardware and artistic abilities that are beyond what they're trying to make it look like. And so when they do zoom in and do those kinds of things, it breaks that illusion where it kind of looks like a weird middle ground of like, oh, well, no, this is clearly actually a three-dimensional object that is made to look pixelated as opposed to a pixelated thing that is just moving in a way. It's kind of like in Celeste, where if you really slow it down and watch it frame by frame, what's her name?
Celeste?
The protagonist.
Oh, it's Madeline?
Madeline.
Yeah, Madeline. Yeah. Because the evil one is Madeline.
Madeline, right. Where she'll like squish down, and then when she like dashes, she elongates.
Yes, it's very like Warner Brothers, Looney Tunes, Hanna-Barbera style, where there's a lot of squash and stretch.
Right. So it's kind of like that, where when you actually kind of stare at it, you're like, wait, no, pixel art can't do this, you know? But it's doing it, and so I agree with you that that kind of, to me, breaks that illusion a little bit.
Yeah, I don't blame them for using new technology. I don't blame them for using 3D but making it look 2D, right? Like, those are all, again, just stylistic choices. But it's like the squash and stretch, I think, is not a bad comparison, because squash and stretch is like animation 101. Like, when you first learn how to like animate, you know, old-fashioned hand-drawn cartoons, that's one of the things you learn. But you're not supposed to see it at, you know, 4 frames per second. You're supposed to see it at full speed. And the 3D masquerading as 2D thing is kind of the same thing. It's like, the illusion is supposed to be perfect. So when the illusion is broken, you're kind of like, huh, that looks a little weird. I do think a small part of the reason they did that isn't just for the technology's sake, but it does make the baddies pop a little more out of the background, which is like crucial. Like, it's really important that you know where the baddies are. So the fact that they look a little more alive and kind of mobile and flexible, whereas the backgrounds are all, I can't think of any exceptions, the backgrounds are all completely static, that helps you, except maybe like candles flickering or something, but like that helps you separate foreground from background. And so, you know, do the edges look a little rough sometimes? Sure. Is it a worthwhile trade-off? Yeah, I think it probably is.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. One of the things that I, and this is something that I don't think we've really spoken about too much on the show thus far. I really loved the visuals and the animation too, because there's some dialogue, right? There's no audio dialogue. It's all written. We have a silent protagonist, though, right?
You get his thoughts a couple of times. Like, if you interact with certain things, you get him thinking, like, you know, whatever made this was huge or something like that.
Right. But he is, like, he doesn't really speak. What I really love is the characterization through the visuals of him interacting with the world around him. Absolutely characterizes the protagonist.
Oh,
you know?
Like thumbs up, giving the middle finger, like kicking doors in instead of ever opening them with his hands.
Yeah, like, I mean, especially the couple that I just remember is, you know, when you defeat the timekeeper, right? So, you know, like you go in and the body of text, it switches all the time, but on the loading screen for that one, I remember saying more often than not was, if this clock is even off by a millisecond, that, you know, dire consequences could happen. And it really makes you think that, like, the clock determines the time on the island, not the other way around. You know, right. Like, that the, yeah, right, the clock somehow is what's keeping time moving on the island,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the clock sets the time. It does not report the time.
Correct, right? So you go in and you fight the timekeeper, and he goes and he says, like, all right, let's end this. And you beat him up, and he goes, like, this will not end well. And the guy just shrugs, you know? The protagonist is just like, eh. And then just, like, picks up, you pick up all the cells, you pick up the gold, you just move on. And it's kind of, it's delightful, and the animation is so kind of over the top on it. I mean, like, and there's another time when one of the people in the cells that you try to kick in, you know, or like slam on there, he says something. He goes, like, you know, oh, this terrible thing will happen. And you, like, nod emphatically and do a thumbs up, you know, and he's like, no, that's terrible. What's wrong with you? And you're like, I don't know. You know? Like, so I don't know. It just it was great characterization, because it kind of followed yourself, like the player, where you're just kind of, you're running and gunning, basically. You're running around, like killing all sorts of stuff, and then people are like, dire things are happening. You're like, sure, whatever, man. I'm just here to kind of platform and kill stuff, whatever, you know? So I thought that was done very well through the visual style.
Yeah, and this game, it does something. This is an indie game, and it does something that a lot of indie games do, which is like there's a lot of self-referential like nods to the developers. Like there's a few places in the world where if you read, you know, a thing on the wall or you examine something, that he does his little, you know, nod and does the thumbs up, but the little thought bubble says something like, you know, really lazy world building, guys. And
yeah,
and like I don't, those jokes don't always land for me. Like sometimes I think they're pretty funny, but they're tough, right? It's a small target. You really got to nail it. And those kinds of jokes, the super exaggerated shrug, the funny, like thumbs up, the, you know, giant middle finger he does whenever he's mad at something. Like he doesn't just like flick you off. He like sticks his arm straight out in front of him and like hunkers down, like as if he's, you know, about to Kamehameha his.
I hope they can see this because I'm doing it as hard as I can.
Yes, exactly like that. and so they, it's almost like the developers are trying to remind you, like, this world is really dark and whatever happened here is really terrible, but, you know, have fun with it. And yeah, and the fact whatever. That all of the characters' animations are kind of like light and springy. He even does like when you dash, he does like the Naruto run. So mm-hmm. It's just like the whole thing, they're just constantly casually reminding you that like the stakes aren't very high and everything's fine. And they do communicate that with character animations in a way that, you're right, we haven't, I don't think we've ever really talked about. And I mean, now we obviously have to replay all 72 games and see if this is something that, you know, other developers got right. I think that's the only way forward.
Yeah, I would agree. So we're going to take a 2.5 year hiatus.
But we'll be back with 72 new episodes.
Woo! Yeah, because that type of batch processing, that's the way to do it, you know?
Yep. I do want to point out that this game, and we'll talk about this in the mechanics, I'm sure, but like this game does a weird new game plus thing, like above and beyond normal roguelike stuff. And part of why that's relevant to the visuals is when you play through each biome, what they call them, each level has
biome.
Yeah, biome.
That sounds like research. That sounds a lot like research. That sounds like something that you saw outside of the game.
Well, I mean,
oh, where'd you get that information from?
I had to look up a couple things because I was not willing to poke every single wall to find some of the hidden keys. And I was like, I need to look up like what are the right ways to start hunting for these keys, right? Because as a nostalgia game, I think the message board context is acceptable, just like for a nostalgia game, like chatting with a friend about it is not considered research.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't like call up the developer and ask them, you know, like minute details. Let's not go crazy. But
no, to be fair, when you said biome, I was like, oh, that's actually a probably good name for it. And then I felt a little bit of shame that like I didn't know that. And then I decided, instead of, you know, deciding to better myself, I just decided to completely rage against you for knowing something I didn't know. I thought that was probably the way to
definitely
go.
The right call. So each biome is very unique, right? No two look quite alike. Even the ones that use like a similar color palette are still organized very differently. Another thing is the way they generate each biome, because it's, you know, it's a roguelike, so it's random every time. Even the layout is consistent biome to biome. Like this one has a lot of long hallways, and this one like spiders from a cent. It's like a hub and spoke, right? You can see that if you open up the map, you're like, oh yeah, this is always kind of laid out and sort of ish this way, right? I mean, within reason, it is still kind of random, but all of that is to say that the enemies are also, with one or two exceptions, like one or two starter enemies that are in basically every biome, there's unique enemies in every single level until you beat the boss the first time and you get the boss cell, and then you're playing on hard. now there are all new enemies plus the old enemies, and for some reason some of the old enemies are now just in other levels, and and you just have to sort of make your peace with that. And that bums me out a little bit, because they did the work of making a bunch of new enemies, but transplanting, you know, enemy A from biome A into biome B makes them stand out in an awkward way, because they're not quite the right colors. They're not quite the right, like, theming, right? And I mean, it's not the end of the world. It's really not that huge of a deal when you're already playing a game where you kind of understand at this point, like, oh yeah, it's a lot of random insanity. But it takes these beautiful graphics and sort of like forces you to notice them in a way that I don't think they were necessarily intending. They wanted to pair the mechanics, I think, of this enemy that's in biome A and that enemy that's in biome C, and now dealing with them at the same time is like a whole new challenge. I totally get that. I really do. But the fact that they visually seem out of place is a little, just a little jarring in a way that bummed me out, especially because they were so thoughtful about how the enemies look and fit into their biome when you play on normal.
Yeah, I didn't notice that as much, but I can definitely, I would agree that that is something that can make that stand out, because, you know, and at least they didn't do something where, you know, they took something from like one of the deep dark blue biomes and put it into, you know, the scorching, you know, yellow biome or something like that, you know, or at least if they did, then I didn't see that much of a huge difference.
It is more subtle than that, but it's enough that after a while I was like, oh wait, this guy's from that other place.
Yeah, and I did notice kind of like right away where, especially for me, it was in the Ramparts, which is the third level, they throw in some bad guys from the Clockwork Tower, you know, and stuff like that. And basically the main thing that I picked up on it with, which was the thing that you listed, which was, oh, it is now interesting mechanically to fight these things out of the normal place. And also that if it was all just new bad guys, that would have been difficult from a cognitive load standpoint, because, you know, when the new bad guy shows up, you don't know what they do or how they act or all that. So you have to learn all of that. And so when I saw the reused bad guys, I was like, oh, I already know what this guy does. You know, it's just I have not seen him here before.
Yeah.
So I think, I definitely visually, I think it is a little bit more jarring. I think it was probably the right call. But yeah, that's definitely a drawback of doing that.
Yeah, and it's one of those, it's the plain white wall, right, with the single spot on it, because the artwork is really excellent and very thoughtful throughout all the biomes and all the enemy designs. All of the bosses are completely unique, right? There's no reuse on any of the bosses or any palette swapping or any nonsense like that anywhere in the game. And so for them to say, okay, we designed this character to go against this background, but now we want to combine their mechanics with this other enemy's mechanics in this other biome, we're just going to take the hit on that it looks sort of weird visually. And you could even probably make the argument that it's like, ah, but the fact that they don't fit in really draws your attention to the fact that they're there and they shouldn't be, right? And now you're playing on hard or extreme or super go kill yourself, whatever the later difficulties are called. Don't know, didn't get there. But it's... I think the mechanical variety is worth the trade-off of a tiny bit of like visual discontinuity. And I suspect, based on how polished the game is overall, that they did not do this haphazardly, right? So to your point, if you had 600 unique enemies and it's like, oh, this enemy moves like this other enemy, you just have to remember that they made them look different so that their colors fit. Like that is not the right trade-off. I think you're absolutely right. That would be the wrong way to solve that problem.
One of the other things that they did visually that I really appreciated was I felt that they had a number of kind of good, I thought that they did a good job varying the visual, the strength of the visual cue based on how much they wanted you paying attention to it. By which I mean that, you know, like there are tons of doors, you know, throughout the levels, right? And most of them require some number of boss cells in order to open, which is interesting mechanically, which we can get to in mechanics. But those doors if they don't if they can open, there is a light above them that says you can open this door. And if they can't open, that's not there. You can still interact with it and knock on it, and it'll say three boss cells required or go away or whatever.
Get
right?
out of here, lame-o.
So, yeah. But the nice thing about that is that, you know, once I realized that, you know, I didn't spend tons of time slamming into every single door saying, like, can I open this? Can I open this? Can I open this? Occasionally I would just to see how many boss cells I needed until I realized that the number of boss cells is actually on the
yes,
door.
Yes, but it's so, very subtle, because if you missed that, that wouldn't be that big of a deal. But the light is very obnoxious because they don't want you to miss that.
Exactly. So, and they do that in a number of different ways. Another one was they won't, they're like when you get the slam down power up, whatever it's called.
The RAM rune or something.
RAM rune. Yeah. When you get that, you know, up until that point, I'd seen like these little runes, but they were, you know, very kind of faded. I'm like, I don't really know what this is or does. And I slam into a few times, whatever. And I got the RAM rune, and it I believe it glows a different color, but I wouldn't swear to that. But it does mark it on your map.
Yeah.
Yep. You know,
yeah, and it's a fairly bright orange, and most of the ground is usually like a black or a dark gray or brown, so the orange pops pretty well.
Right. The orange pops pretty well. I would catch it, I'd say 85% of the time, just playing, but then whenever I would open up my map, which I do fairly regularly, because there is some backtracking in there, and they have teleporters set up to assist with that, but we'll get into that mechanics. But whenever I'd open up my map, there would be this icon, you know, there. And I'd be like, oh, I should go. I can interact with that. But those icons never appeared until I got the thing that I needed in order to interact with it, because it was pointless information to have, you know. And so I really kind of liked that. And to me, it helped with the Metroidvania portion of it, because, you know, as I wasn't constantly being beset with all this, like, oh, you can't go here. Nope, you can't go here. Nope, you can't go there. But then once I get this new thing, I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is like a thing that can happen. And then the world got bigger, you know, like right when I got that, because then all of a sudden it'd be like, oh, hey, just so you know, these are areas where you can interact with this. And you're like, oh, wow. I didn't even know that stuff was there before. And now look at how much more depth there is to each of these levels.
I will say, hilariously, my counterexample, because I completely agree with you that that was a thoughtful way to do that, instead of being like, okay, now you've got the super bombs, go into every room and set off a super bomb and see what happens, right? Like, that's can be very frustrating in Metroidvania games in backtrackers. So I like that they were thoughtful about it in this game, particularly that spot's not always going to be there. As soon as you die, that world doesn't exist anymore. So, like, they're trying to balance out discovery and not just having to poke every wall to see what happens. The glaring counterexample is the spider rune that lets you run up walls, because mm-hmm. there's no way to hide a gigantic shaft with no platforms that you obviously need to be able to wall jump to get up. And so yes. that is a thing that I know I had to look up on a message board, because the runes are only available in specific. This is probably where I learned the word biome. The runes are only available in specific biomes. And after, I don't know, my 30th run, I was just like, okay. Obviously, I get something that either allows me to wall jump or run up walls or shoot a grappling hook or friggin' something, because there is no way they would just allow the random gen. This isn't No Man's Sky. They're not going to just allow it to randomly generate a gigantic vertical shaft that is impossible for me to go up. And after certain biomes, you can go like to the left biome or the right biome, like when you're leaving where the collector is. And after, I can't remember which one, but after one of the biomes, the right biome is always one that requires the spider climb. And so...
Yes, the slumbering village. There's Stilt Village and the other one.
Yeah, the slumbering sassafras.
Sanctuary?
It might be Slumbering Sanctuary. Yes, it is, because I like that one. And Stilt Village can just go... Oh, God. Anyway. So... But yeah, so that was something that I was like, okay, there's an obvious visual cue here of like, you could go here if you had the right thing. And they don't mark that one on the map because it's just a giant, it's obvious. Like, it's obvious, it's inherent to the map that there's a giant vertical shaft over there. So like, I agree with you that they were very thoughtful about not making you set off super bombs in every room just to see what happens with this one hilarious counterexample. But I mean, what were they going to do? Like, there's no way they could just be like, oh, well, if you run and jump really hard, then you could go up there. Like, that'd be stupid. Like, you need to have the spider climb.
Right. And I mean, and even then, there's no point that they really make you, like you said, go, like, you know, oh, I have this new ability. Now I have to go try it on, you know, I have to put a bomb against every wall. And that would be antithetical to the overall gameplay because it's timed, you know, which is a very specific mechanic that we'll get into in mechanics. But yeah, so I thought that was a very nice, there were a number of nice, clean visuals in that area where at no point did I feel like I was struggling to make heads or tails of the environment. You know, I always very cleanly knew what I could interact with, what I couldn't interact with, and what each thing did. And that's not something that's easy to pull off in a game.
Well, particularly a game where there, cause this, I don't know if I've ever heard of another game quite like this, where it's like, oh, you get additional ways to explore the world. So the world needs to have other places to explore, but only if you have those abilities, but also it's randomly generated. So sometimes those things are there in abundance. Sometimes they're there in scarcity. Sometimes they're not there at all, but there's like a certain balance that they have to strike. And it shows how visually thoughtful they were. And I mean, the engine that must drive it, but how visually thoughtful they were about how do we communicate this information and make it like enticing and exciting and not mind-numbingly frustrating where you're constantly like, I want to go over there. Like, I want to go over there and you're not letting me, right? Like, they have to actually reduce quite a bit the amount that you use your like traversal power-ups, because if they were just constantly in your face, you would constantly be annoyed by it. So it's really quite well executed. I want to contrast that with what I have listed in my notes as visual noise. So around the time you're getting powerful, depending on how good of a player you are, I guess, around the time you're getting powerful enough to beat the Hand of the King, and then when you start playing on hard and you have a bunch of power-ups unlocked, your traps are higher levels, you have some of the crazy powers that are higher levels and stuff, there is a lot of crap going on the screen at any given moment. And if you ended up in a weird place where you've like you haven't optimized your like your element, I guess, there can be just an unholy number of particle effects on the screen at any given moment.
Yep.
Because I had a thing where enemies froze when they died and froze nearby enemies. So it was doing that like ice explosion effect. But then I had a trap that made enemies burn when they died. And then I was wearing an amulet that created a poison cloud when I took damage. And on hard, the game is fairly hard for a player of my game's literacy. So for my game's literacy, not yours, champion. So, but there were a lot of times, admitted it was Teddy, you just watched him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and he was blindfolded.
But there were a lot of times where I would be in like a tense encounter and would be starting to lose the thread because there was just so much visual information, just like, oh, there's a green cloud and this white flash and everything's on fire. And I can see like the trail from my sword and the enemy tells, which thank God those exist. But like the enemy tells are flashing all over the place, trying to, you know, help me know what to do and parry or dodge roll. Like, it wasn't always helpful. I was like, I feel powerful, but I also feel like the amount of visual clutter that this creates actually hampers my ability to use all of these powers effectively.
Yes, I would definitely agree that that is true. That didn't bother me, and I actually kind of liked it for two reasons. One is that there would literally be sometimes where, you know, if I had, you know, whatever, like the sinew slicer or a deployable skill, right? So you have a deployable skill that like leaves a trail of fire, you know, and then you yourself have, you know, something that freezes things, and then there's a poison cloud, and then You have something that enemies burn when they die, and then another thing where enemies also emit a toxic cloud when they die. Like, you know, so it's just like what, and there's an area with like four or five clustered bad guys, and two of them are bad guys that spawn other bad guys, right? So you just
enemies spawn biters when they die, so now there's other moving things that are helpful, not harmful, which is also like visually confusing.
Yes, yeah. So basically, whenever that would happen, right, you know, and I'd see like a cluster of like bad guys, be like, let's do this. I would just go in, hit L2 and R2 immediately, and then just start just mashing like crazy, being like, just everybody dies. And so the fact that to me, it was just kind of like when you walk in and just a smoke cloud happens, and then, you know, you walk out and like you're bloodied and beaten a little bit, but like everybody else is dead, you know? So that, I mean, like I said, like it just put me into a particular type of frenzy. That also being said, and this is mechanics, but now it's just a good time to mention it as any, is if I had that type of situation going on, and then I decided to try my hand at a cursed chest, right? It completely changed the way I would approach combat, and cursed chests in general changed this, because I knew that, you know, when I would go in guns blazing like that, I was absolutely going to win that encounter. You know, they weren't going to deal me so much damage all of a sudden that I was going to drop, you know, but I would definitely get hit. And so if I was cursed, then all of a sudden I'd be like, I can't afford to have 50 different particle effects going on at once. So I'd like jump in, toss down my two deployable skills and then run away, you know, and then just kind of be like, let's just see how all of that plays out. And then I'll determine what my next step is, you know.
Did you often go for cursed chests? Because I tried maybe a dozen, and the first several, I died really bad. And then eventually I was like, oh, okay, I can do this. And then after, I don't know, the fourth or fifth or sixth one where I successfully completed the curse, I was like, this is never worth it. This is just bragging rights. I have nowhere near a fragile enough ego that I'm going to let this trash talking chest make me risk my entire run.
I do. I used cursed chest in a very discriminating way, which was I would only use them if I had gotten to the point where I had hit a cursed chest and my loadout was so poor that I felt that the only way for me to have a good run was for me to chance the cursed chest. You know,
that's fair.
Where
that's
I was like,
legit.
Where I was like, I'm already dead two stages from now if I can't get better equipment. So I might as well just roll the dice and see if I can either end it sooner rather than later or get good equipment. And then sometimes, you say hit me and you go bust because I would be cursed when the cursed chest would pop out an item. I'm like, this is completely antithetical to my current loadout. So. So even if I survive the curse, I'm still screwed two levels from now. I still remember when it kicked out that thing. I'm like, this is completely, completely useless for me. Thank you, cursed chest. You are the living worst. But yeah, so I'd say about 85% of the time I wouldn't chance it. But there were definitely some times where I was like, sure. Or if like, you know, I had to go do something, I'd be like, well, let's see how this plays out, because this is either going to end my run right now and then I can just go do whatever I need to do, or I'll save and quit with even better equipment. You know,
I want to make sure I at least toss a mention to the subtle world building that is done essentially through artwork in the background, because there's a lot of world building that is done essentially through artwork in the background. And you can interact with a lot of this subtle world building where it's like, oh, there's a bunch of alchemy stuff over here. And if you look at it, you know, you get like a smarmy comment, or you read a letter from the king to the alchemist, or you see like all of the, there's sometimes, I don't think it's always there, but sometimes you could see like the room in the clock tower where all the swords are that the timekeeper literally then uses during the fight, right? And there's all these just little, like before the, on your way to the conjunctivitis boss fight, you can see larger and larger holes smashed in the wall. And if you examine them, the player character gets increasingly concerned that the same creature could possibly be making these small holes and giant holes in the wall. And so there's not a ton of story. The game's story is pretty light, but the world building is fairly deep. And it's done in such a way where you're constantly like, tell me more. Like, how did we even end up here? Why are we on this horrible island? What is the world outside of this island also magical and full of horrible monsters? Or is it like Seinfeld out there, but, you know, Dead Cells in here, right? There's, you're just constantly sort of like, ooh, tell me more, tell me more. And they just drip it out to you in a way that's interactive, right? They don't just shove it in your face, but you have to like notice these little things in the beautiful artwork backgrounds and then interact with them and see what little bit of additional information you can glean from that. And mostly it's useless, right? Mostly it's just to make the world feel more alive. It doesn't really change the way you play, or you don't get anything most of the time. But it's, I think for a game like this, the kind of story they wanted to tell, the kind of world they wanted to build, this is a fantastic way to make you sort of like slow down, because there's so many elements that we'll talk about in mechanics that like are like, go faster, do this faster, like ignore everything, just blaze right through. And you would miss all of this world building if you didn't stop and smell the roses. So there's like this push and pull, or this push and pull, where it's like, do I want to play this way but sort of have motion blur where I don't see most of what's going by me at 1,000 miles an hour, or do I want to slow down and see the world and collect more cells and elongate my run, right? So they kind of accommodate either play style, and baking it into the visuals with a silent protagonist, I think, is a smart way to do it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And also, too, I think that the way that they add that is unobtrusive, you know, because you could literally play the entire game and just never deal with any of that. If you're not here for any type of narrative, any type of world building, you don't have to be. It, you know, it's not like they're going to, the only times when they, I think literally there's only one time that I can think of where they force some amount of narrative on you, and that's when you fight the timekeeper, and he literally says two things, you know. And he says, let's end this, and
this won't end well.
Yeah, that's it, you know. And so, but aside from that, you can just blaze through all that. You don't even need to touch it. You don't even need to think about it, right? Which, again, you know, for me is nice, because, you know, Teddy loves this game. He has no idea what all's going on with the world, and he doesn't care, you know, because he can't read. But, like, I think it's interesting. So I like how basically they're like, we're going to build out, narrative is not going to be a core aesthetic to this game, but it's there. If you want to dip your feet in it and, you know, kind of enjoy that, then here it is. And if not, then never come to this well. It is not a problem.
So do you have any other notes on visuals? All right.
Nah, audio.
Here's my segue for you. I feel like the visual cues of enemy is about to murder house you are really excellent, and the audio cues of what is happening, like has a bomb been dropped, has a, you know, a freeze effect or a burning effect or a poison effect or anything else like been triggered, supplement that in a way that as the combat gets more frantic are increasingly necessary. They're not, you mm-hmm. could play this game on silent or mute if you really wanted to, but you would be missing some genuinely helpful audio information about particularly what is happening in combat. I mean, that's mostly all the game is, but you don't need audio to explore, but you do benefit tremendously from audio in combat situations.
Yes, I agree completely. And actually, that's kind of some of my main notes surrounding that is like, you know, you've got a, what was it? The two that were the most stark for me was, one is when your cool skills stop, like when they have finished cooling down, they make a very distinct noise that lets you know, like, hey, the skill is now usable again, which I used all the time because you don't have time to sit there and look down at your skill cooldown when everything is going to pot.
Well, right? Especially against like elites and bosses where you need to deploy the skill multiple times during the encounter, but also you're still in the encounter and can't ignore them trying to murder you.
Exactly. But to me, the biggest one that when I realized it was happening, I was like, oh my God, this is so amazing, is the critical sound effect.
Oh my God.
Every weapon that you have makes a different noise when you crit versus when you don't.
Huh.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, no, actually, this is one you should definitely go back and double check. because did you ever use the infantry? I think it's the infantry bow, the one that crits when you're really close to people.
Yes.
Yeah. So try, like, you know, it works with any of them, but also the other one that I is really easy to do is the, oh, I forget what it's called, but it's like the vengeance sword, where basically every time you take damage, you crit for a little bit.
Oh, is that the frenzy sword?
I think it's the spite sword or something. Spite something.
Yeah. There's a lot of equipment in this game.
Yes. Yes, there is. But all that being said is that, yeah, when you hit somebody, it'll make like the normal swish, swish, swish sound. But then you crit, it makes like a harder noise. You know, so you could tell when you're critting versus when you're not. Now, apparently, a negative side is that it is a little, occluded, you know. So clearly, you know, if so far out of our sample population, 50% of the people were picked up on it, that's not ideal. But that being said, is I used that all the time because it would let me know whether or not I was meeting the requirements to crit, you know. Which, well, and sometimes made a pretty stark difference.
I would say that the reason I may not have noticed this as like being a thing I needed to care about compared to some of the other sound effects that I took very clear notice of is if you were using equipment where making that equipment crit is like that's the strategy for that sword or that whatever, mm-hmm. like then you would need to learn sort of like, oh, I did the thing right, like parrying with the shield mm-hmm. makes a parry noise, and it pops the word parry onto the screen in tiny letters, which is almost hilariously unnecessary, but it because you can clearly see if you successfully parried, and it says parry, and it's weird. But if you're using a loadout where it's like, oh, if you roll behind them and stab them in the back, then you'll crit. Or if you every third swing is a crit. So you need to get into a rhythm of like 1-2 crit, 1-2 crit, right? Like if you're playing that style, then you're more likely to care about the crit noise. Whereas I know I had at least a couple of blueprints unlocked that did like fancy things for criticals, but I tended not to rely on them. So I wasn't hearing that information in a way that altered my playstyle. So I probably was like, oh, I critted with this weapon, but because it didn't make me behave any different, I didn't need to take note of it, right? Whereas if it's like, oh, I need to do 1-2 crit, 1-2 crit or whatever, then I would have to care about the visual and the sound effect that backed up that playstyle.
Yeah, it's kind of a high-pitched ting. So yeah, go back and just, you know, for whatever weapon, you know, just try hammering its crit thing. Because some of them, especially for the melee weapons, they don't crit at all, you right. know? So, go check that out because that was one that, you know, like I said, I used pretty regularly, but all that being said, they are constantly feeding you audio information. And I think that you made a very apt point, which was, you could play this game with the sound off. Like it is playable. There is no audio cue that like requires then user input, but I would say that would make the game substantially harder.
Oh, yeah. And less enjoyable because one of the other things that I think is important in the audio is the music in this game is as varied as any of the visuals, right? Mm-hmm. Every biome has its own little melody, and they feel not just varied but thematically super appropriate, right? When you get to the High Castle, right? When you get to High Castle, mm-hmm. that music is like charging you onwards, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're just like, yeah, I'm almost there. Like, I'm almost to the end. And you just want to like blast through that level. But it's the longest biome because you have to go through the doors and get the keys. And like, just takes for friggin' ever. But it's good. Like, it's really an exciting stage. It's visually so different because everything looks nice, whereas everything else is like decrepit or haunted or worse. And you have music that's so well paired with all of the visuals in terms of just literally they feel like they go together, but also they kind of set the emotional tone, right? Like, oh, this is the creepy fishing village, and like, oh, this is the, you know, the gross toxic sewers. And one of the things I love about indie games in the modern era particularly is they almost always release their soundtracks on the internet. So if you like this music, and I like this music, you can find the soundtrack and stream it on like Spotify or Google Play Music or YouTube or whatever. And so When we first started playing this game, I was traveling a bunch for work, and so I was often in situations where I was either playing with the sound off or so low that it might as well have been off. And I was like, I know I am missing all of this beautiful music. I bet the soundtrack is online. And so I just started listening to it while I was working.
Nice, nice. And yeah, I also, you know, to follow up, the music is spectacular and very thematically appropriate. Like the Stilt Village, where it's like an old fishing, decrepit fishing village, you know? The other thing is, you know, in each loading screen, they have, you know, kind of some world building that, you know, you could totally ignore or get on board with. But like one of them, for Stilt Village, there's a couple of them that I really enjoy. Like it used to take weeks for the docks to smell that bad, you know, or is that smell normal? You know, like stuff like that. So it really gets the idea of like it's this rotting, fetid place, but it's got kind of like a very like pirate, not shanty, but you know, it definitely feels like something that you could potentially hear while on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disney.
Yeah, you know? I also wish I was capable of describing this in a way that didn't make us sound like idiots, but there's a certain like instrument palette that they're relying on. There's a certain here's a good example. Most of the songs and even some of the just sound effects use choir, like wordless, just like vocalizing a lot of like deeper men's notes, but I think it sounds like it's a four-part choir. And it, like when you grab a scroll, it like makes the glass shattering sound. And then when you hold it up, it goes like, oh, right. And a lot of the musical pieces also have choir parts like that in them where it's just vocalizing. I don't think they're saying anything. If they are, it's either made up or like Latin or something where it's not meant to be identifiable.
It's made up.
Yeah, I mean, there's Latin. There's no way that was real.
I mean, who speaks that nowadays?
Scientists.
Barely.
They're not intending, even if it is a real language with real lyrics, they're not intending for you to be singing along, right? But they're including voices in a world that feels very, and when I say voices, I mean like as instruments, in a world that's very empty and threatening when it comes to other things that are alive and could potentially have a voice, right? The only friendly things you deal with are the collector, which you know that dude is not on your side. And then the what would you call him? The blacksmith, I guess, the guy who works in the forge. Mm-hmm. And then the like mutations mutant. That's it. Like everybody else is trying to murder you, always murder you. So hearing these like haunting voices as part of the music kind of, it's like, oh, those are like the haunting cries of like other dead prisoners, or like this is the battle cry of like somebody who's coming to stab me in the face, right? Like it makes the world feel alive to have music that includes literally voices, especially in a game where there is no spoken part, right? It's all done through text. So I once I noticed like, oh, there's choir not just in the music but also in the sound effects, I was like, good, I like that. Good.
good. Yeah, it's one of the other things is, yeah, it's the there's this, the blacksmith that runs the forge, there's the guy who retools your weapon,
yeah, his,
or whatever,
like assistant.
Yeah, his assistant, right? And what I really love is that his assistant has a whetstone or a wet wheel or whatever, you know?
I think whetstone's the right term for that. Yeah, it's a grindstone.
Grindstone, right. He's got a grindstone, and it was like, and you know, if you go and you look at it, the character says, a grindstone to reforge a bow or a magic item. I don't know. Seems like sloppy game design. And that's kind of like to the tongue-in-cheek stuff that you were talking about before. But yeah, no, the music is really, really spot on. And then just one thing that we kind of alluded to, and you effectively touched on, but just to give it one quick touch, which is not only are there tons of audio cues for how you're interacting with the world, but there are tons of audio cues for, I think pretty much every bad guy, or the vast majority of them, have not only a visual telegraph, but an audio telegraph as well.
Earlier enemies.
Especially the earlier enemies, and especially the ranged enemies, mm-hmm. the ones that aren't the aren't going to melee attack you. The one that just I almost can't hear some of the background music without hearing the enemy telegraph audio cue in it is those priest-looking guys that can fire
horns,
energy.
Yes, and it goes like...
Yeah, that. Like, I can't hear the rampart music without hearing that just constantly in the background, you know? But yeah, I mean, so they've got that as well. So if, especially, at no point did I get hit or take damage to where I felt like, oh, that came out of nowhere. There was no way for me to prepare for that, you know, which I think is, you know, I think is very important. But that's pretty much what I had for audio.
Yeah, I'm good to go on to controls and mechanics. I have one just quick comment about controls, just because this was a weird experience for me. This is a 2D game for all intents and purposes, and that means you could, if you are a sane person, use the D-pad, or if you are a crazy person, you could use the analog stick. And I am not a crazy person, or at least I try not to be. So when I first started playing this, I was playing...
If you were a crazy person, how would you know?
Oh my God! So when I first started playing this, I was playing on my laptop, which I have paired with my old PlayStation 3 controller. And I was like, ooh, yeah, this D-pad, this is perfect for this. This feels great. And then I recently came into a gaming PC, and it's Windows, so it's easier to use an Xbox controller than to use a PlayStation controller. I know you can use a PlayStation controller. I've just been too lazy to pair it yet. Please don't harass me on the internet. But the Xbox 360 controller famously has the crappiest D-pad ever made. It's so bad that I actually, for the last, you know, like few days that we were playing this game, actually had to force myself to play it with the analog stick, because I would rather use a control I am unfamiliar with than a familiar control that sucks.
So just to be clear, the D-pad was so bad that you had to completely change the way that you were playing, but not quite that, all of that discomfort and frustration over a fair period of time was not quite enough, not quite beyond the threshold to get your lazy ass together and figure out to configure the PlayStation controller and use that.
Oh, no, I mean, I'll get there. No, this is not sustainable long term. I cannot continue to play games that require, or I would prefer to use the D-pad and use the Xbox 360 D-pad, because it's just the worst. And we can move on from this, but it's just the worst.
and also, too, I didn't mean to call you lazy before. You were a very diligent, hardworking individual.
Aww.
But sometimes I'm just like, you know, we give each other garbage, but then at some point I'm just kind of like, you know, we're still friends. first and foremost, let's talk about the different weapon types, styles. Okay, so there's so much equipment, right, in this game, and it all behaves very differently. So there's three main kind of flavors of equipment. There's brutality, tactics, and survival, but basically swords, bows, and shields, you know, or sword, melee, ranged, and the one I just used.
I think the audience just learned everything they need to know about your play style.
Well, okay, all right. And I don't know if we've ever discussed this, and this is a bit of a tangent, but here's the reason why I always opt for glass cannon instead of like walking tank, you know, what that deals no damage, right? Is because, okay, so let's say that I've got 100 hit points, right? Like me and the bad guy both have 100 hit points, and we both deal, you know, 10 DPS, right? Then it will take 10 seconds for us to hammer away at each other and for one of us to expire, right? Now, if we both have 10 hit points and deal 100 DPS, right, then we will clash, and in 1 second, one way or another, that battle will suss itself, right? So it is more time efficient to go DPS than it is to build a tank that takes forever to slog through anything. I am really confident in my math that overall, people who play DPS-based characters have shorter cycle times and get through games faster than tank characters, assuming that there is a solid, like, game that you know, gameplay being neutral, like, you know, skill level.
Yeah, a well-balanced game.
Right. So, for me,
because I know cycle time, if you, like, that's going to be on your tombstone, right? Your autobiography will be titled Cycle Time. Like, this is a thing that is deeply important to you, and I almost never go out of my way to throw this into my notes because I'm like, George will bring up the cycle time.
But, George won't shut the hell up about
it. I mean, it's a super important part of game design, but it's like, I don't have to call you in the morning and be like, did you eat? Right? Like, I know you won't go too long without remembering to eat, because eventually you'll die and you like to be alive. Right. So,
yeah. And I won't go too long without mentioning cycle time because I'll die and I like being
exactly
alive.
It's a weird gypsy curse, but what are you going to do? So the thing that I have been considering, particularly playing this game, but it extrapolates to a lot of other game styles, is when I'm thinking about, do I want to deal a lot of damage or do I want to be able to soak a lot of damage? The question it comes down to for me is, how good am I at not taking damage? Because on normal, I eventually got to the point where I was just like laying enemies out. Like I was the threat to the island, right? I could go through whole biomes and like not even take damage for a while.
You weren't locked in there with them. They were locked in
yes.
there with you.
Like the game was, you know, had just become the Rorschach story. But then when I would go up to hard, and I mean, granted it didn't start out that way, but then like when I would go up to hard, I would actually have to change up my playstyle because it was like, I can't kill this enemy fast enough that I'm able to risk them hitting me, because if they hit me, it's going to ruin everything, right? Whereas on normal, I had found a balance that worked for my skill level where I was like, okay, I can roll in, I can do this, I can do that, and then they're dead, and then I can roll on out of there, right? But when you go up to hard, like obviously the same tactics don't work because that wouldn't be a very interesting game, right? So for me, DPS is all about, can I kill them fast enough for my skill level regarding how much damage they're going to deal? Because sometimes like you take the hit because that is the tactically advantageous thing to do. But on hard, it is almost never the strategically advantageous thing to do, because when one enemy does 50% of your life in a single blow, it's like, well, I only get to make that decision once because I can't choose to get hit again. I will die.
Right. Well, and so the way, and again, my not to take this too far and detract from the game, but this is the kind of stuff that I chug and dink around with regularly. So just indulge me. So the idea then, right, is that, like, let's say in any given encounter, right, because the way I look at it is what's your error rate? Right. So you make, let's assume that if you played perfectly, you would never get hit. Right.
Fair. Yeah. I mean, that's how Teddy plays, right?
Only when he's blindfolded. For some reason, being able to see really throws this game off.
He's nervous visually.
I like the idea that when he's blindfolded, he's playing like some like 50-year-old stage master, and you take his blindfold off and he goes right back to being a 4-year-old. You know, he's just like button mashing like a madman. But okay, so let's say when you play the game perfectly, right, you take no damage, right? So then error rate can be measured in units time, right? I typically make an error.
Yeah, every X, yeah, okay. No, go ahead. I see where you're going.
Every X seconds, right? So therefore, right, is if you have more hit points, right, but you do proportionally less damage, right, then all you've done is elongate that battle, right? Because if that battle went from taking 5 seconds to taking 50 seconds and you make an error once every 2.5 seconds, you've gone from making 2 errors to 20 errors, right? So therefore, right, it is that the battle would end approximately the same way. It would just take longer. The only way
and have bigger numbers.
But yeah, so then the idea would be is that the only reason to have more hit points is if during that elongated encounter you are lowering the rate at which you make errors. all that being said, is that the point is you want to take it out of the hit point domain and put it into the time domain, right? And that's so you have to have conversion factors, right, to get from HP to units time. And I said all of that to say I really liked the different items that they had in this game. I thought,
what's the exchange rate?
Accommodated
what's the exchange rate of Stanley Nichols to Shroot Bucks? What's the exchange rate of unicorns and leprechauns?
but anyways, no, I did think that the items did accommodate a large number of play styles, and because of it's a roguelike, and because the equipment is not only is the equipment that you get generated, but the quality of the equipment is randomly generated, mm-hmm. right? So I may have an item that I absolutely love, but it's a one plus, and then I come across one that I'm like kind of lukewarm about, but it's a 8.2 plus, you know, and I'm like, well, I now need to figure out how to be better at using this weapon, because this is clearly the superior option. I mean, that's obviously a hyperbolic example, but you know, I can't tell you, and this is a tangent off that, the fact that they pause the game when you're chugging that math is super important, right? Because I definitely spent a number of time in treasure rooms, literally just like going like, just staring at the loadout being like, I'm way more skilled with this loadout, but darn if this isn't like also a decent loadout and probably better. Can I get better at this? And so it forces you, the player, to get better at the game, because it really incentivizes you not getting into the exact same rhythm and the exact same play style over and over again. It's nearly impossible. Well,
and you are tiptoeing possibly unknowingly around a mechanic that was definitely an intentional choice, and definitely once someone on a message board shattered this glass for me, I was like, damn it, because this game, in true roguelike fashion, you can't really like cheat with your saves. If you really want to, like, if you're playing on PC, you can go in and like copy your save files and like dick around with it, but like don't do that. Like don't suck all the fun out of the game.
Yes, right. It's way more time consuming. Yeah, right?
Like just either get better at the game or enjoy the skill level you're at. But like don't do that. But one of the things that I realized is that I had spent a lot of cells unlocking things that sucked and I hated and are terrible. Yep. And everyone who likes them is wrong and is playing the game wrong. But once they're unlocked forever. And because items mm-hmm. are now randomly generated or randomly, you know, sprinkled throughout the world, that means that now this piece of crap you will never, ever use is ruining the random generation. And so I saw someone on a message board literally say, the correct way to play this game is to play all the way through normal and unlock everything, figure out what you like, delete your save, start over, and only unlock the things you like so that the frequency they come up will be like nearly 100%. And I was like, yep. That's not quite save scumming. Like, that's not quite cheating the game, but the only way to learn what things you like and what things you don't is to introduce them into your life permanently. And mm-hmm. I don't think that was an accident. I think that they did that on purpose. I'm not surprised that they didn't build in a mechanic that's like, pay 100,000 gold to delete this item forever, because they're like, you can pay to shuffle what's in the store. You can pay to change your mutations mm-hmm. on a given run. So like, they clearly thought about those kinds of mechanics, but once you unlock a blueprint, it's unlocked forever. You just have to freaking deal with it. And there are so, so many blueprints, like the Nutcracker, that I would just
yep.
get out of my life forever, to the point where I seriously considered, before I beat the game the first time, or, you know, normal difficulty, I seriously considered actually restarting to get some of this crap out of my life.
But no, and you could theoretically do that. But I kind of caught wise to that later than I would have liked, but earlier than never, which was, you know, after I unlocked like two or three things that were just I did not care for at all. Right, I did become a lot more careful with what I unlock. So if it was a mutation, I'd be like, yeah, sure, because you can just pick those, you know. But whenever, like, there were some grenades that I never unlocked. Like, I had the blueprint for them, and it was like, one of them was like, roots an enemy to the ground. I'm like, could not possibly care less about that. You know, that's what the wolf trap's for. just get, nope. And so I never unlocked it. And then, so what I would end up spending cells on, which I think is, and I don't know when this happened. So first thing I did was I, you know, spent all my cells to get the maximum amount of gold carryover and all the stuff that makes it a roguelite.
Permanent upgrades.
Right. So blew all my cells on that. Right. And then at some point, and I'm not sure exactly when, you know, like you and I want to believe, I want to clap my hands and believe that it's from the beginning and they're just screwing with you, which is you don't have to spend all of your cells every time you talk to that weird creepy dude.
The collector. And yes, you know, it is from the beginning. From the word go, you can just roll right through the door without spending your cells. Yep.
That is spectacular because it's like, you know, I go up to the door and it's like, oh, you got to spend all of your cells. I'm like, yeah, okay, go back, spend all my cells. And then at just some point, I just slammed through that door and I was like, oh, I can knock this down, you dick. and then I never spent another cell on something that, you know, I never spent any more time on anything that I wasn't passionate about.
No, don't have to empty your pockets every time you walk past a store, you become like a friggin' hermit essentialist. You're just like, I'm only going to spend money on things I want. And then if I lose all my money, it doesn't matter because I was going to lose it all anyway.
Right. And so that's the thing. But then that creates a very interesting mechanic, which is that, you know, now all of a sudden, as opposed to being able to lock your cells in every level, you only lock them in every four levels because you only lock them in when you have a boss and then you go to the forge and can spend your cells there. So as opposed to like when I died, I'd lose like 15 cells. I'm like, you know, what are you going to do? You win some, you lose some, whatever. As opposed to now when like I'd be typically fighting the boss with, you know, 125 cells in my pockets. And I'd be like, don't die, don't die, don't die, don't die. And then a couple of times, you know, I like, because Megan's sitting beside me playing Civilization VI, which is a good game. She'd be sitting beside me playing that and she'd like hear like, oh, come on. And then and she'd be like, what? I'm like, no, it's fair. It's fine. It's just, he did a couple of things in quick succession that he doesn't normally do, and it's okay. It's okay. I lost a lot of money in the casino tonight, and I'm just not too happy.
But we're
going to
bounce back. We're going to be fine. We're going to be fine. Yeah. Teddy's clothes still fit, right? This is fine.
Yeah, this is okay. but yeah, so I thought that was an interesting mechanic.
I want to talk about the timing and how you're being timed constantly. Before we do, I just want to make sure I at least casually mention this game.
It totally sounded like you were about to do an ad right there. But before we do, I'd like to do a shout out to Blue Apron. Have you tried Blue Apron? It's the greatest way to order food and cook it for yourself, but pay more money for it.
So I listen to a lot of podcasts. I do think it's funny the ads that have completely gone out of style and the ones that have like stood the test of time. Like, every human being on earth has at least two or three Squarespace sites, yet I still hear commercials for Squarespace because they must still be working. And then there's all these like Silicon Valley BS startups nobody gives a crap about. You know they're going to flame out, but you hear about them on every single podcast for like 6 months. And then one day you're just like, huh, I haven't heard a Blue Apron ad in a while. It's like that company is either gone or is on its way out and can no longer afford podcast advertisements.
Or they, I don't know, because I honestly, the only reason why I know Blue Apron is still around is because Death Battle is sponsored by them semi-regularly, and they still, I still see, you know. And which is weird because it's a YouTube video. So it's like, you know, all right, before we get into this amazing death battle between, you know,
Goku
like
and Superman.
Link and, yeah, between Goku and Superman, between Link and Cloud, Link wins. suck it. But anyways.
Suck it, both hands.
Before we get into this epic battle, would you like to hear something from Blue Apron? It's like, yes, I would like to track this video 2 minutes into the future and not listen to any of this.
Skip, moving on. And death battle. No, but the thing, I'm not going into an ad, not yet. But the thing that I just want to mention, this game did really well for me personally. This game did a really good job of making me feel fancy. There were times, like once I got the controls down and I sort of understood the play style that worked for me. And I got, you know, decent at the dodge roll, and I got, you know, like, oh, this loadout lets me play in a way where I can be like fairly aggressive, right? There were a lot of times where I would do stuff where I would literally pause and turn to Susan and just be like, did you see that? Did you see how impressive of a badass I am? Right? That's when you have those moments where you're like, they're not locked mm-hmm. in here with me, right? It's like, there was one, just this one, like, I wish I was like a Twitch streamer and I had a recording of this. I was on a little platform and I was being chased by an enemy. I shot an enemy in the face with the freeze bow, then rolled off of the platform, double jumped up, shot the freeze bow to get the one who had chased me off the platform. And then I was using, I think it's like the assassin daggers or something. It's a sword that pulls you forward when you swing it. And then I attacked myself back onto the edge of the platform where the two enemies were frozen and murdered them. And I was like,
nice.
This is the way people who are really good at Smash Brothers must feel, where you're like, you're fighting off the edge of the platform. And it's like the first person to make a mistake is going to die because we're off the edge of the platform. There's nothing to land on. Right. I was like, there's just so many little moments where you like, you jump, you know, you like double jump off of a ladder and you're like already firing your bow or swing your giant sword or whatever. Like you jump up and you deploy a trap and then you like, you know, speed dash to the other side and like melee that guy while the trap is killing this other guy, but then he gets away from the trap and then you murder him like he's trying to sneak up behind you. Like just so much of that. And I don't think I'm particularly good at this game, to be honest. And like, if the game could give me that feeling of like I am such a badass at my skill level, people who can get all five boss cells and actually like get to the true ending, it must be like totally bananas to watch the way they play, because the character can get permanently more powerful, but only a little bit. Most of that improvement came from me, the player, right? Like I started at a certain ability level and I got to an ability level where I was like, I am enjoying being this character. Like this is satisfying to be in this world and just be hacking down enemies.
Yes. No, I couldn't agree more. And that actually brings me to one of the things that I definitely want to make sure that I touch on, but is one of the, and I don't know if it necessarily is a core aesthetic of the game, but one of the things that I definitely get out of the game is abnegation, right? So basically that is, you know, kind of game as pastime, right? But it's really nice because basically I can just sit there and, you know, turn on the game and then you just kind of get into a good rhythm of it where, you know, you get your skills, you get your loadout, whatever it is. And because, you know, the game forces you to get skilled at a varied number and type of loadouts, you get, you know, it eventually kind of matters less and less what your loadout is. And they're all fairly intuitive. So, you know, as you're just kind of going through the game, you know, and you're pulling off like awesome stuff like that, where, you know, like you throw an ice bomb down and that freezes a whole bunch of people. And then you throw the firebomb down. So then that sets them all on fire. So then you roll away and you start attacking the other guy, you know, but then one of the guys had enough hit points to where he's, you know, like you have to double back and deal with him. So you double jump over the rocket that he fired at you. And then, you know, you fire your arrow while you're still in the air and it takes care of that guy. And then that spawns biters. So, you know, that's going to take care of the other thing. You know, just that rhythm that you kind of get into, you know, is to me, I fell into that rhythm so many times that I really feel that it can't have been an accident. And the two things that I think reinforce that is, as we mentioned, one, the game is timed. So it does force you to be conscientious of that, right? You're always kind of like trying to move faster, you know, because there are distinct in-game rewards for being able to complete stages within a certain time limit, right? So you're trying to move quickly. And as you kill people, the more people you kill in succession, the more it boosts your speed, the faster you move. So basically what they do is they say like hit AAB, 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 AAB. And so at first it's like hit AAB. You've got that? Good. Okay, now AAB. Now a little bit faster, a little bit faster, a little bit faster. But because the speed is, and they don't draw a lot of your attention to it. They don't say like speed up. You know, the game just slowly speeds up as you're playing to the point where, as you said, I was doing stuff with a reaction time that if you had just thrown at me, I've been like, I can't do that. But, you know, because it's slowly built over time. Yeah, the game really does an amazing job just kind of putting you in that almost like soft focused,
that,
you know,
like zen-like state.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think is incredibly difficult to design and achieve. And I think this game did it really well.
Well, and I want to talk specifically about the, and I know we're running long, but it's interesting. So everybody shut up. I want to make sure we talk specifically about the incentive to move through a biome quickly because of the timer unlock rooms in between. Mm-hmm. So their inclusion is interesting, but I want to start with a story. When I first started playing, I was being very cautious. I was really kind of trying to like feel it out and understand the world and understand the controls and everything. And then I was like, oh, there's these timer rooms. And one of them is, I think if you are in the 30-second, like you could be on any number of minutes, but if you're within the 10 seconds between, you know, 30 and 40, it will unlock that door. You know what I'm talking about? I think it's only after the first biome.
After the first biome, and I may be wrong on this, but it's the room that says 30 above it. Yeah, that's, you have to kill 30 enemies without taking damage.
Oh, okay. See that.
So they're incentivizing two different types of behaviors. One is playing well without taking damage, because all of the biomes have, you have to kill X number of opponents without taking damage. And some of them have time-based rewards, right? So
see, I never knocked on the door, and it would have told me what the barrier to entry was. I never knocked on the door because it was right next to a timer door, so I just assumed. Yeah.
Yeah. No, because one time, man, I got both doors. It was like crazy.
Yes. Yeah. So here's the thing. Because I was playing super cautiously and casually, well, not casually, but cautiously for sure, I didn't realize that the 30 door was, you know, kill 30 enemies without taking damage. So the first time that door opened, I was like, oh, did something go horribly wrong? Because I was like, I didn't finish it in 30 seconds. What I thought it was I happened to be in the 30 second window, you know, like 10 minutes and 32 right. seconds. And so I went in there and I got like the best equipment I'd ever had, because this was relatively early in my playthrough. And I was like, oh my God, like this is amazing. Like the stuff that's in these rooms, like this is how you play the game. They want you to go as fast as possible. So you unlock the timer doors, you get the super equipment, and that's how you make progress. And this is where I made my mistake, because I was going quickly for the wrong reasons. Because I believe that when you first start playing the game, you should optimize for cell collection. And you do that by killing all of the enemies and going everywhere, right? And because the permanent upgrades, like the maximum amount of gold you carry over and the larger flask, like those upgrades matter. And so unlocking those relatively early in the game by getting as many cells as possible, as quickly as possible, I think is the right way, at least for someone of my skill level, to play a game like this. And then you can start hauling butt and trying to get through the timer doors if you want to. But once I understood what those doors represented and what my skill level as a player afforded me the ability to do, I actually went back to canvassing the entirety of every biome, and I never looked back. I was like, I would rather go through, clear out everything, you know, get to the boss, get through the forge, and then get the forge upgrades, because that is helping me based on my playstyle, which loadout I like to have. Like, that was how I eventually made my way to beating the boss for the first time. And if that mechanic had been a little more obvious to me, and I'm not saying this is the game's fault, but if that mechanic had been a little bit more obvious to me, like when you want to go for speed and when you want to go for thoroughness, I probably, like my first like 20 runs would have felt more productive. Whereas instead I was just like, I'm never going to unlock these permanent upgrades, because I'm like hauling ass to go all the way through, and I get through the level and I have like 3 cells. And then inside the room, right. like, yeah, there's like the thing with 20 cells. But if you clear out the whole level, you might get 30, 40, 50 cells, right? And so right. it didn't really jive with my playstyle. So like the beginning of me playing the game was actually a lot of kind of frustration and confusion, where I was like, I don't really know how to make progress. Like, I know this is a roguelite, but I don't feel like I'm making any progress. And then once I worked it out, I was like, oh, okay, because this is what I should be doing for my playstyle. And then I made it work and it was fine. But like, there was a minute where I was like, I might bail on this game. Like, this, I feel like I'm just doing the same thing over and over and I'm not getting anywhere. And then once, you know, the curtain was raised, it was great. But there was a risky moment there where I might have bailed.
There was a risky business moment. There was a moment where you were just in your underwear and you know, a dress shirt and all that good stuff. Well, anyway, so, I mean, that's kind of the bulk of, I mean, we could go on ad infinitum about, well, in almost any topic between the two of us. But that being said, certainly about this game. So so I don't know if you had anything that you absolutely wanted to make sure you wanted to touch on.
This is just a thing that I think has to be said. The way you get the true ending of this game is unreasonably hard.
You
have to beat the game, and then you get a boss cell, and then you have to beat the game on the harder difficulty, and you get another boss cell, and then four times, so that you have five boss cells. You have to beat the game again, and then you can go on to the true final boss, which I watched a YouTube video of just someone beating the true final boss to see what it looked like, and I was just like, no, this is completely unreasonable. And in a small way, I don't think that they really expect most players to get there, and this is actually how I'm going to segue into describing whether or not I think the game held up or learned from history, rather, is this game to me is more roguelite than it is Metroidvania. If you like roguelites, this is a phenomenal game. If you like platforming combat games, this is a phenomenal game. If you like Metroidvanias, it has some Metroidvania elements, some backtracker elements, and they're good. They're well applied. They add an interesting layer to the roguelite elements. I'm glad that they're there, but do not play this game if you're expecting Super Metroid or Castlevania Symphony of the Night. That's not what this is. That's not what it's trying to be. And it's more like inspired by, or it's like fusion cuisine, right? It is very much a roguelite with heavy combat emphasis. And it has some Metroidvania elements that are applied in really smart, really thoughtful ways. But you come for the Metroidvania, you stay for the roguelite, right? If you try to do it the other way, I don't think you'd have a very good experience. So the reason I say that matters is a roguelite, in my mind, and maybe this is just my skill level, is not a game you play to finish. It is a game you play, and at some point you stop. And when I had that realization that I was just like, oh, I don't actually have to beat this game to have enjoyed it and to have wrung all of my joy out of it. I just have to stop playing before it's no longer like fun for me. And so I basically got to that point literally right before we started recording, because I got the closest to beating it on hard I've ever gotten. I died catastrophically. And then I was like, okay, all right. Let's go record a podcast. I think I've seen all I needed to see here.
Yes, I would agree with you. So did it learn from history? I think so. You know, I would definitely say that this is a good game. I would recommend that people pick it up. I would also agree that, so, and we've kind of discussed this in brief, where we've talked about basically how to name genres, and the fact that genres are named after games is not ultimately very helpful, because then if they are not beholden entirely to everything that game did, then you could argue that it's not in that genre. So that's not super helpful. So you've kind of coined the term backtracker as a kind of a name for Metroidvanias. And my counter to that was that it's more of like an unfolding game. You know, that backtracking is an element of it, but that, you know, you're given like a small world that slowly unfolds over time, right? And I think that's to me why the reason why we're in two different camps here is because you don't mind the backtracking element of Metroidvanias.
I like the bet hedging of you know, don't it like you don't want to blow your brains out over it, which is your opinion creeping into assessing my opinion.
Yeah, well, because that's because I can be that broad spectrum because it does make me want to blow my brains out. And that's all. So, I mean, I can give you the entire rest of the spectrum. You can have the whole house. You can have the whole fucking house because all I need is the blow your brains out room because that makes me want to blow my brains out. So all of that being said is that, you know, that's why, like, to me, the thing that I like about Metroidvanias is I like the idea of a game that unfolds over time. And this game does do that, you know, is that, and so that's the element of Metroidvanias that I actually enjoy. So yeah, I mean, this game, in my opinion, absolutely held up. It, if I had to put it into two different camps, you know, Gohan Super Saiyan or Gohan Super Saiyan 2, I would definitely say that, you know, this is a Gohan Super Saiyan 2 level game.
So you said that it held up, and what you meant to say was, did it learn from history? So this run is dead. We got to do the whole episode over.
The curtain falls. The music plays. The credits roll. Then it all fades to black. And you're left by yourself. The fanfare is gone. There's no player two. There by your side to share victories won. But as you slowly progress down the hall to your bed, a few great events leak back into your head. From the time that you spent traversing the land, battling evil, fighting the darkness, just sword in hand. Your memories creeping with the edge of a smile. You realize again what you've lost for a while. You're gonna think back much less on how you saved the day than on all the experience gained. At the end of it all, gamers play what we play.
George.
Hi, Lions.